This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last month, adjunct faculty at Burlington College, Champlain College, and St. Michael's College all voted separately to join the Service Employees International Union. The faculty say they are looking for stability, benefits, and increased compensation, and hope a union might help. Earlier this week, VPR's Alex Keefe spoke with Peter Hans Matthews, a labor economist at Middlebury College, about the situation of adjunct professors across the country and why efforts to form unions have proved successful.
The face of education has changed dramatically in the last half century. 50 years ago, 75% of all academics were tenured or tenure track. At this point, the numbers have completely flipped. It's now the case that about 20 or 25% are tenured or tenure track. The rest are adjuncts who work under a variety of conditions, often not particularly hospitable.
Today on the program, we're going to look at the experience of adjunct faculty and how they operate at some of our local institutions. So if you are an adjunct faculty member or lecturer, perhaps your classes are canceled today, you can give us a call and tell us why you do what you do, if your goal is to get a tenure track position or not, and what you think might work for colleges and universities and for the people who teach their courses. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note at the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're joined today by Genevieve Jacobs, adjunct professor at Champlain College and at CCV. Welcome to the program. It's nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane. Wonderful to be here.
And we're also joined today by Sean Witters, a lecturer in the English department at the University of Vermont. He's a member of the UVM Faculty Union, United Academics, and he's also served on the last part-time bargaining negotiation unit. Welcome to the program for you as well.
Thank you, Jane.
And Sean, let me ask you first, you actually don't like the term adjunct, so let me get that right out there. Why not?
Well, the term adjunct is deceptive and even self-contradictory. If we look at the word in the Oxford English Dictionary, the dictionary of reference in my field, it means associated, connected, added, subordinate, supplementary. In U.S. education, junior, temporary, or casual. And in logic, something added to the essence of a thing, an accompanying quality, property, or circumstance, a non-essential attribute. Now, to understand the dilemma of the lecture, we must recognize the contradiction in the term. We're deeply connected to the university. I'm deeply connected to the University of Vermont. I'm a Vermonter. I went to UVM. I came back here to raise a family. I'm in a dual income household where my wife and I make it work here in the state. We're committed to living here. And I'm committed, deeply committed, and I think my students tend to think I'm often almost too passionate about things like this, like I quoted the Oxford English Dictionary just now, to deep and rich teaching. I don't feel non-essential to UVM at all. I've been here since 2006, and this year I was fortunate enough, based on the feedback of my peers and my students, to win the university's highest teaching award. I don't feel non-essential at all, and that term adjunct to me really speaks to the shift that's happened, which your previous speaker from Middlebury noted, in academia. There's a 286% increase in the number of part-time faculty in the last 30 years. And accompanying that, we should also note, this is the part in terms of the money and student tuition and expense, is a 141% increase in senior executive administrative pay, which I think we know from our experiences in Vermont tends to be in the six-figure range. In other words, and we saw this with our recent provost hire at UVM, who got an additional $100,000 over the previous person who occupied that position, that could hire two of me. Or it could hire one of me and provide scholarships to two or three UVM students.
All right. So there we go. An argument against the word adjunct and perhaps the attending definitions that make you feel like it's something that's non-essential when, Sean Witters, you say you are essential. Genevieve Jacobs, what about you? Do you mind the term adjunct? Do you have the same semantic argument?
I completely agree with what Sean has said so eloquently. We are essential persons and we are essential to our students in the classroom. As you've pointed out, Sean, as things happen now, in contrast to 23 years ago when I first began teaching and developing the art of teaching and some level of mastery in that field, my most beloved occupation, we have seen that the word contingent might actually apply to our full-time as well as our part-time faculty. That would be the difference between tenure positions, which are very scarce on the ground and becoming more so, and the rest of us. And so Sean and I and all of our colleagues share a very insecure, what has been called a precarious position in our calling, in our vocation. We're highly skilled with the amount of time that we put in. We do develop mastery. We are, of necessity, all highly educated. Many of the young ones coming in, and some of us older ones, are in considerable student debt ourselves in order to become qualified as professors. So although nobody goes into teaching for the money that I know of, we do go into it for the love of it and the absolute value that we place in knowledge.
Well, and it is a career, as you said, and something that you do expect to make a living at. Do you mind if I ask you approximately how much do you get paid for these courses that you teach, or what do mm-hmm. people in your position typically get paid?
Well, the maximum that a so-called adjunct, shall I continue using the term adjunct, or should
you
we
know,
go to part-time?
So it depends on you, because we're not always talking about part-time people either. We're talking in some cases about
right.
people who are teaching a full course load or
yes.
or teaching at several institutions more than a full course load. So
that
I don't know.
That would be my category.
It's up to you. If you don't mind, right. I may continue using the word adjunct mm-hmm. for clarification purposes.
Sean,
you're
raising
something
your finger. About the word part-time as well.
Yeah.
The word part-time is broadly used here. I just used it to describe the shift in faculty apportionment at universities. In fact, part-time is also a deceptive word. I'll give you an example in my own employment. I've worked at UVM since 2006 in both the part-time and full-time units. For much of my early years at UVM, I worked in both the College of Continuing Education and the College of Arts and Science. Now, that didn't count towards full-time status, even though I was teaching the same course load to the same students, with the same number of students, often in the same classrooms at the same time as regular courses, but it was considered part-time and not full-time. So the word itself, again, is deceptive, and I think so much of what we're talking about has to do with the world that many people outside of academia hear terms from but haven't actually encountered in terms of what they mean for our professional status. That, to me, is what's really important about the union, by the way, is it clarifies this. So this, for me, the union isn't just about making sure I have a fair wage. It actually really does so much in terms of making sure I have a voice at the table, making sure my working conditions are clear, my professional development and professional expectations are clear. And that's one of those things that our union has been working on, for example, making sure that if you're teaching at UVM, if you're teaching a full-time load, you should be treated as a full-time employee of the university with access to benefits and so forth.
And so, Sean Wetters, you prefer to be called a lecturer and just leave it at that.
I'm fine with that.
Okay,
yes.
But Genevieve, you can use whatever word you want. So I was asking you,
all right.
People
perhaps a contingency. Contingent
sure.
would be a good term. And I'll just note that shorthand on a practical level, from the administration's point of view, part-time or adjunct means people who can be employed to handle the classroom load at less than a livable wage with no benefits, no cost in benefits to the college. So that, just to clarify, that's not really how I see it, but that would be that is the distinction.
Well, and we got a note from Jerry who says, I spent one semester as a quote-unquote adjunct. They called me professor, and I figure I made about 75 cents an hour that I put in, creating the course, developing all the materials, and then presenting it and dealing with students. When I was done, I learned that I would have to apply to teach another course. That felt a lot like seeing if I could find a bigger hammer to hit my thumb with. But Genevieve Jacobs, on that question of payment, I mean, certainly many people in many professions, and even if you think about lecturers and professors who have a full-time contract with benefits, mm-hmm. are spending more hours than 40 hours a week. But so if you calculate payment, you just said less than livable wage. Why is that? Because a typical course is, what, $1,300, $1,000?
Well, a typical course itself, and a course would be a 3-credit course. I don't want to get too specific. There are small variations between the different colleges that mm-hmm. I teach at. But typically, it's about $3,500 per course. The maximum number of courses that you can teach, if you are so fortunate as to teach the full load as a so-called part-time person, is 3 courses per semester. 1 course in the summer and another 3 in the fall. Indeed, that's what I've been doing only triple it.
Because you're doing it at more than one institution.
Yes, exactly, for many, many, many years. So the numbers really would be, after taxes, it works out to less than $20,000 a year if you're only working at one college. Now, if you were working as a professional in your field, or as many adjuncts have to do, working in some field that isn't even related to their academic discipline in order to survive, then you're really sort of up the creek, because, as you pointed out, or the example of the person who emailed in, you're really at the mercy of scheduling constraints. How do you get away from your other job in order to come and do this fabulous thing called teaching in the classroom twice a week or once a week?
We are hearing from many people who are in this field and have thoughts to share. If you'd like to share yours, you can post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Ellen wrote in to say, I don't teach a full load of classes, but if I did, I would still qualify for food stamps. Vito says, it's obvious universities and colleges pay huge salaries to administration, staff, and full-time faculty. Students are graduating with so much debt, it's crippling the national economy, and banks are increasing costs for student loans thanks to Republicans in Congress. So universities and colleges hire adjunct professors in an effort to save pennies. Pam says, I was a visiting lecturer at Temple University. When I asked what did I have to do to get health benefits as an adjunct, I was told to get a PhD and tenure. I was paid hardly anything, so I gave up college teaching and I started in public schools.
How sad.
And let's go to Kaylin, who's calling in from Jeffersonville. Hi, Kaylin. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd just like to say that my adjuncts were indispensable. I based my schedule around them. Having a working professional come in and basically mentor us, indispensable. And also, at the same time, the president was getting raises and all that stuff. But that's all I had to say.
Kaylin, thanks for that call. Betsy's on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Betsy. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm an adjunct at Champlain College, and I'm pretty excited about the union efforts over there because I think it's going to make a good change. And particularly, I think it's also going to help full-timers, because right now, with so many adjuncts, they get stuck with all of the administrative work because adjuncts can't currently do that because of the whole limitation on part-time hours. And so if we have the opportunity to get some more hours and maybe get paid to take on admin work, that could really be a win for everybody.
Betsy, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. Hearing from more professors and lecturers who are in that adjunct category that is so contentious even as a word because of what it means to people who say, look, we're experts in our field. We're doing full-time work. We are doing the work of teaching your students. So why aren't we getting paid more and perhaps getting more respect? We're talking about that today. And if you'd like to share your thoughts, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we are looking at the experience of adjunct professors in our local colleges and universities. Last month, adjunct faculty at Burlington College, Champlain College, and St. Michael's College all voted to join a union. So we're hearing about why adjuncts are treated differently in terms of employment than their fully employed colleagues, and how they make a living, or try to make a living, teaching. We are talking with Sean Witters, a lecturer at the English Department at the University of Vermont. He's a member of the UVM Faculty Union, United Academics. And we're speaking with Genevieve Jacobs, an adjunct professor at Champlain College and at CCV, who was part of recent unionizing efforts. And if you'd like to share your thoughts with us or questions that you might have, our number is 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Stephanie says, I paid more in childcare so that I could work than I made as an adjunct. It was untenable. A couple of years ago, I did an internship to get a license to teach high school. Even with a PhD, I needed a secondary license. I now make more teaching high school than I ever did as a non-tenure track college professor. No one believes me when I tell them this. I also feel much more supported professionally than I was as a non-tenure track professor. David says, when I was finishing up my PhD, I was an adjunct at SUNY Albany. Each class had about 120 students and met twice a week. I had to make all my own copies, pay for my own parking pass, grade everything, all 120 of whatever I assigned. The chair of the department once told me that it would be fine if I just showed movies for most of the classes and had multiple choice exams. The real kicker, David says, is when I went to the SUNY food court for coffee at the end of the semester, Wendy's restaurant was hiring, and after pausing to make sure my math was right, I realized an entry-level Wendy's employee was making twice as much as I was. And let's go to Rob, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Rob. You're on.
Hi. Quick question and a comment. The question is, we have to remember that the higher ed system in the United States today is completely broken. Tuition costs are rising, and we're treating our adjunct faculty and many other faculty, paying them less and less money. There's overhead. It's not just all because of senior administration, but a lot of it has to do with tenured administration. So if you're looking for a much better job and a much better position where you can earn between $4,000 and $18,000 per section, I'd really encourage all the adjunct faculty and faculty listening to check out Aplerno.com. It's a Vermont institution and startup approved by the state of Vermont to offer courses for transfer credit. You know, adjuncts and faculty are the treasure of institutions, but they're getting treated like absolute junk. And the only way we change it is to redesign higher ed from the ground up. So check us out. I hope you guys get, you know, at the local universities and colleges, get a much better situation in terms of your pay. But their business model is completely broken, and we're going to have to just do some radical changes.
All right, Rob, I hear you on that. Let's put that to our guests. Sean Witters, what do you think?
I'm not willing to cede ground in the university, and that's why I'm here, actually, and that's why I'm part of a union. What we're looking at is a shift in priorities in the institution, by the way, which began during boom times, not during deficit eras. We should make this point. And we've seen at UVM, particularly at my institution, the issue is not whether there's money or not, but where the money is being delegated. And there's a general shift away from an emphasis on faculty as part of governance, as part of the essence of the institution, to go back to my quibble with the adjunct term in the first place, and with students as being at the center of that. And I really see common cause between students and faculty in this regard. There's much work to be done at the universities, and I think it would be a mistake to cede ground on this and simply say this. I think much needs to be changed, and it has to do with beginning to turn around the culture of accountability in our broader culture, we might note, and in university institutions. One thing I would note, our recent Board of Trustees meeting this fall was held it held its public comment period at 8:05 a.m. on a Saturday for 15 minutes. Whatever you think about UVM as an institution, that is something to really think about.
And you're going to leave it there?
I will leave it out in the ether. Yeah, I will leave it there. That speaks for itself a great deal, I think.
So, Sean Witters, you just said you don't want to cede ground to the university. And you said earlier, you know, this is something you're passionate about. And as a UVM alum, you there are things that you really value about the institution. But for both of you, let me ask you, because if this is an untenable situation, why do it? Why not find another career? Why not join the listeners we heard from who said, I couldn't do this, so now I teach in secondary education in high schools? Your position is not unique in the sense that there are a lot of professions that rely on contract workers who don't get benefits, who often don't get paid very well, who are at-will employees who can get fired at a moment's notice because they don't have these contracts. Is it because of the level of education that you had to attain that it feels like, hey, we deserve more? Or is there something else that's going on here? Because, you know, this is not a unique situation in the working world. And Genevieve Jacobs, let me go to you first, and then Sean will come back to you.
Thank you. I love teaching. As simple as that. This is the most meaningful contribution I feel I can make in my lifetime to my society, my culture. I love my students. I think it's all about relationship. And every time that I've considered moving to a more practical and livable, sustainable field, I'm also a counselor and I also love that line of work, I would feel that I'm deserting my students. And there is kind of the country clubification of higher ed, great emphasis on facilities and marketing and looking good, looking slick, kind of like a sort of the Facebook trivia of what makes an education valuable. And I know that the students need the dedication that Sean and the rest of my colleagues bring in the classroom.
But if you and others are still willing to teach at what you say are untenable wages, mm-hmm. how is it going to change, Sean Witters?
Well, at the beginning of every class I teach, I ask my students to read an essay called The Banking Model of Education by the great scholar and activist Paulo Freire. And in the beginning of that book, he writes that in every historical situation, humanization and dehumanization are possibilities. I still believe that humanization is a possibility. This is why I teach. This is what I, and this isn't just about my relationship to the institution or my colleagues. This is about my relationship with my students. And that's why I'm in the classroom in the first place, is to be able to have those encounters, to open my students up and to open myself up in my encounter with them to real knowledge. And real knowledge isn't something that we bank. It isn't an object that we put away. It's an event that happens in space and time between people. Jane, you and I right now are having a moment where we're present with an idea. Your listeners are present with this idea. It's resonating for us. This is what good teaching does. And frankly, my life would be impoverished if I didn't get to be in that moment in space and time with knowledge. That is why I teach. And that's what matters to me. And that's what we want at a university, is it not? People that are that passionate and committed to the experience of knowledge as an encounter.
Sean Witters, if UVM came to you or another institution came to you and said, we've got a tenure track English position, would you take it? Is that what you're looking for, ideally?
That's a difficult question, and in part just personally because my family's here. I have two small children. We have roots in Vermont. My family is here. My wife and I are both committed here. And by the way, also, this is a classic Vermont story for young professionals. We moved here to raise a family. My wife has an important career. She works for the Department of Environmental Conservation. She's an accomplished employee there and well-respected and makes important contributions to my community. And so in many ways, part of my fight to stay at UVM is my fight to stay here in Vermont. And that's also a question in terms of UVM's hiring practices and the hiring practices of other universities in Vermont and colleges, is that people give up things to be in Vermont. And this is a choice that a lot of people on the lower scale of employment are routinely expected to make. But when it comes to higher ups, we're told that these are what the market forces demand and there's really no choice. But the question that we should have is, what are people willing to commit to the institutions that really matter to us here in Vermont, in our communities, and in the world that we value?
If I could comment,
yes,
on
please,
that as
Genevieve
well,
Jacobs.
I would say Vermont's leading the nation now. Thank goodness. With our unions, the three unions that we've just formed, and UVM already having established us a good example, there's no geographical escape from the situation. Market forces do not actually dictate the exploitation of human resources at this level. They do not dictate astronomical profits and revenue coming in on the backs of laborers such as ourselves. There has been a 66% rise in tuition across the country over the last 10 years, and most of the revenue from that tuition has gone into real estate, buildings, more land, more facilities. There is an old story about Zen monks visiting Harvard to see how we do education. And so the guide takes them all from, well, here's the library, here's the dean's office. Oh, look, here's the classrooms, look at our laboratory, look at the gymnasium, here's the auditorium. And at the end of the day, the guide says, so are there any questions? You've now seen everything. And the lead monk says, thank you very much, but where is the university? Right? So the university is in the people, in us, in the relationships, as Sean said. And that priority is what we need to respect in order to restore integrity to higher education, which is not properly a business like other businesses. As John Dewey, great Vermonter, progressive education, said, education is an end in and of itself. It is not a product, as Sean pointed out, Paoli Freire. Yeah. And we need to absolutely restore that mission to our colleges.
We got a note from Marjorie who wrote in to say, I have been an adjunct at Johnson State College for 16 years. We've been unionized via the AFT for quite a few years. We get $5,000 a course now after several years teaching, and we have a seniority system which adds to security. When I left Community College of Vermont for Johnson in 1998, the adjuncts were in the process of voting not to be in a union, which I thought was too bad. And let's go to Naomi calling in from Moncton. Hi, Naomi. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point that as long as we are working for lower wages, and I am an adjunct at Champlain myself, that we're undermining the degrees that our students are getting, which is a betrayal of our students. And I just think it's incredibly important that we make the workplace equitable and live up to the values that we have.
Naomi, thanks for your call. I appreciate that point that you're making. We'll let that stand
so
there
true.
For a moment. And let's go to Anne calling in from Burlington. Hi, Anne, your thoughts.
Hi, Jane. I just want to make the point that there would be no jazz courses at UVM back in the day. This is before the Jazz Festival in Burlington and all the wonderful notoriety and praise that we've gotten over the decades. Had not the education department at UVM appointed Ed Bemis as, visiting lecturer. And he gave the first jazz courses at UVM. He was grilled by the faculty before they let him do this. And the rest is history, as I say. The students would stop him in the street and ask if he were going to teach the next year. And he would tell them, go ask the powers that be, and he would be more specific than that, to offer my course. The students wanted it. He was passionate about jazz and spreading the word.
Anne, I hear you. That's a really interesting story, and goes as well to the point that Sean Witters was making earlier about, you know, that he received the University of Vermont's highest teaching award recently, and students who are saying, hey, here are teachers that we have that we value. We got a call from a student who said he worked his schedule around the adjunct professors because he found them to be the best. Let's go to Richard in Plattsburgh, New York. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello, Jane. I had a number of comments. One, to a point that you made, that the problems of low-wage workers is similar in many other fields, and that's unquestionably true, but there are some fundamental differences. One of them is, you know, many of the adjuncts have PhDs, and their specific training is in teaching. And the other is that we're not paid as hourly workers, and the number of hours that we have to devote to grading papers, to preparing for class, to doing research, can be quite extensive. And the pay in the at Plattsburgh State, for example, is $840 per credit, which works out to $25.20 a course. At the community colleges, it's much less. And we have 195 adjuncts at Plattsburgh State, and in terms of percentage, we're much lower than, say, the Vermont State College system. I worked at Lyndon State, and I can tell you the number of adjuncts there is significantly higher. But we have adjuncts who are receiving public assistance and who are literally well below the poverty line, teaching three courses at a time. And the numbers are staggering. At one point, you know, trying to figure out what's the breaking point, at what point, and I realize there is none.
Yeah, Richard, I hear you. I'm going to stop you there because we're short on time. But, you know, that's an interesting question. What is the breaking point? And hearing from so many adjunct professors, and I know that word grates on some, but that idea of these people who are teaching in our colleges and universities who say they're not making much money. And again, we're hearing these experiences today. We're not speaking with administrators at these colleges today who can talk about some of the financial pressures they feel or the balance that they feel they're striking. But before we let our guests go today, I'm just curious, you know, here as you think about this, what you think would work? What's a fix? I mean, colleges do have pressures, and they have teachers like you who will work for this.
Well, I have a lot of tensions with the institutional trends in universities, and I think there's some specific problems at the University of Vermont. But I really want to say that not everybody has in the administration is operating in bad faith, and I've had many wonderful conversations with administrators that make me hopeful about the institution as well. I should also add that I've gone around and talked to colleagues who were here before the unionization, and they said their experience as lecturers was far more chaotic, and that's really what's important about United Academics and the UA, which you'll post links to the website into the AAUP report that I mentioned previously, but that it creates a basis for collaboration and a conversation between faculty and administration, and it organizes things. It's a simple thing to say, but it organizes the relationship in a way that ensures a greater sense of justice and equity, even when the trends might be going the opposite direction.
That's Sean Witters. He's a lecturer in the English department at the University of Vermont and a member of the UVM Faculty Union, Union Academics. And we're also talking with Genevieve Jacobs. Your final thoughts here before we go.
Thank you. I think the people and the professors, with the support of the students, have spoken coherently, clearly, with our landslide victory for the union at three colleges all at once, simultaneously, within the last 2 weeks. I don't think the people are going to take it anymore.
That's Genevieve Jacobs. She's an adjunct professor at Champlain College and at CCV. She also has a private psychotherapy practice. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In November of this year, seven people died from heroin overdoses in the Upper Valley. It turns out all of them had used heroin laced with a drug called fentanyl. Dr. Ben Nordstrom is the director of addiction services at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, and he joins us now. Dr. Nordstrom, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
First of all, what is fentanyl? Describe the drug.
So fentanyl is a drug that works on the same opioid receptors in our brains that drugs like heroin or morphine or methadone work on, or oxycodone for that matter. They bind to the same receptors in our brain that endorphins are meant to bind to.
And fentanyl is a drug that's used in medicine. It's often used in anesthesia, right?
Correct. It's frequently used for sedation purposes. It's used in intensive care rooms. It's used in pain control as well.
So how does it end up in heroin?
So heroin dealers add fentanyl for a couple of reasons. One is because it binds to that same receptor, it can actually punch up the effect of the heroin. So it's a much, much stronger and much more potent a drug than heroin is. And so it can be used to either boost the effect of the heroin, or it can be used to make up for the fact that the heroin is of low quality, is impure, so it's not very strong, so they kind of strengthen it or bolster it by adding fentanyl.
You know, it's interesting because often in the past when we've heard about drug dealers cutting drugs with other substances, it's usually to make the drug go farther, but not necessarily to make it stronger. Why are they putting fentanyl in? You mentioned that the heroin might not be that strong, so they're adding a little fentanyl to give that kicker?
Right, absolutely. And part of it turns on the fact that fentanyl is much more potent. And so if you have your hands on even a small amount of heroin, you can make that go a long way. So it can be used to sort of stretch out a limited heroin supply. But then other times it's been used as essentially to create kind of a novel experience and to kind of produce sort of extra, extra strong heroin. And the difficulty with it is because the end user has no idea what's in it, in the product that they're buying and in the product that they're using, they wind up not being able to calculate the risks that they're assuming. And it's very, very easy to overdose on fentanyl.
Well, explain that a little further. I mentioned that there were seven overdoses of fentanyl-laced heroin in the Upper Valley just last month. People are dying because they think they're just getting their regular dose, I guess you could say, of heroin, and instead it's a much stronger high.
Absolutely. That, you know, heroin is typically measured in terms of milligrams. You know, it's same with morphine. You know, how many milligrams of morphine do you need to get an effect? And the same thing's true with heroin, is how many milligrams of heroin actually needs to be in the drug that people are using in order to feel it. And that studies have shown that like a typical bag of heroin will have somewhere between 1 and 25 milligrams of heroin in it. Now, when you're talking about fentanyl, you're talking about fractions of a milligram. You're talking about micrograms. And dangerous doses of fentanyl can therefore be just much, much smaller than dangerous doses of heroin or morphine.
And there's no way to tell when you're taking it. If you are a person who's getting high on heroin, there's no way to tell that there's fentanyl in there.
No. Not prospectively, not without being able to do sort of extensive laboratory testing.
Which presumably most people are not.
Yeah, probably not walking around with the gear that they need to do that.
So where is this fentanyl coming from that is getting into the heroin supply?
I don't have a good answer for that. A lot of it is probably diverted because we know that that heroin is a Schedule I drug in this country, but fentanyl is a Schedule II drug, meaning that the DEA has identified that fentanyl does have some medical uses. So it is a technically a legal drug, although it's a very restricted drug, but there is a supply out there. In addition, you know, fentanyl could be produced clandestinely.
When you mentioned that there is a supply out there, fentanyl, though, is not like some narcotics like Vicodin or OxyContin, which are prescribed outside of a hospital for somebody to take at home. Is fentanyl only given out in the hospital, so that diversion is happening in a hospital among medical professionals?
Well, for the kind of heroin that, or for the kind of fentanyl that ends up in fentanyl, a lot of it is going to be the powdered form that hospitals could get their hands on. But fentanyl is available in forms that people can have to take at home, and the most common one is what's called a fentanyl patch, or it's a transdermal patch that has fentanyl in it that people can put on, and then they absorb the drug through their skin, and it provides pain control that way. So there are lots of ways that people can get fentanyl as a home prescription. It just doesn't look the same as it does when it's being used in intensive care settings.
I got it. Okay. And in fact, some drug addicts are actually seeking out fentanyl itself to get a high off of.
Yes. It's not one of the most commonly misused drugs simply because the access is so restricted to it relative to things like oxycodone, relative to, you know, Vicodin and things like that. But there are people who do seek it out and misuse it.
In some cases, those people are doctors and anesthesiologists. There is an issue with addiction, fentanyl addiction, among healthcare professionals?
Absolutely. Because fentanyl is so potent, it can take even small amounts and can have big effects. So it turns out to be one of the most commonly diverted drugs by healthcare professionals.
So then what are hospitals doing to keep fentanyl from ending up either on the street or misused in the hands of people who work in healthcare settings?
Well, all hospitals work in concert with the DEA around this. The Drug Enforcement Administration has very, very strict guidelines that have to be followed about how these medications are stored, used, how their use is tracked. And all hospitals have very, very careful, essentially accounting measures to know exactly who took out the drug, how much of the drug they took out, how much of the drug was delivered to the patient, and then in the event that all of the drug that was taken out wasn't given to the patient, then you need essentially a witness to show you, you know, to watch you waste the rest to make sure that it's not being diverted. So hospitals do an awful lot to try to make sure that that the medication doesn't get used for any purpose other than its intended.
Ben Nordstrom is the director of addiction services at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. He's been telling us about the dangers of a drug called fentanyl. 7 people died of an overdose of fentanyl-laced heroin in the Upper Valley in November. Dr. Nordstrom, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for your time.
And that will do it for today's program. Tomorrow, what is up with this weather we've been having? Our region just got hit with a rather strange storm, but we're certainly not immune to weird weather events. We are going to look at the year in meteorology and get some clues on what we can expect for the rest of this winter season. Send your weather-related questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net or post your weather photos on the Vermont Edition Facebook page and then listen to the program tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Isla Yersel. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.